Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark. Horror at the Hospital, Volume 3, Story 1. Okay, these experiences are from my limited 3 years as a nurse. In the nursing home or assisted living setting, I have heard the shuffle of feet in a carpeted hallway with no one there. Any nurse who has worked in a nursing home at night knows that noise and knows to go check who is up, especially on a skilled rehab floor. Otherwise, the next noise might be the god-awful thump of a body hitting the floor. But in a particular skilled rehab home in Maine, which was shaped like a Y with a nurse's station in the stem, one side of the Y was haunted and the other was not. Guess which assignment I got stuck with 9 times out of 10. Something was shuffled down the carpeted hallway, and there was also the shadow. Same nursing home, different ghost. At the delta of the Y was the oxygen room / clean hold across from the nurse's station. The door was solid, but it had a thin window that ran along the side of the door down the entire length. The light in that room was always on, so we could just dart in and get what we needed. If you were standing at the nurse's station, you could see a shadow pass back and forth in the pool of light. One night, an aide and I got ambitious and checked that whole room out. Nothing was hanging or swinging free to cause that shadow, and another aide standing at the nurse's station said it went away as soon as we went in there. The shadow would follow us down that hallway. I can't count how many times I would be in a patient's room doing checks and a shadow would pass by the doorway. Even patients would ask if there was another person coming in. Same nursing home. A preacher was in end-stage cancer with brain mets. Out of his treetop, mean, swinging at us, big guy too, only in his late 50s, would take 4 of us to provide patient care and turn him. We called him Big Guy. The night he died, the regular staff nurse and I were in there administering morphine. This place had 2 nurses sign off on the administration of injected narcs. And he said, "It's so hot. I don't want to go there. Don't make me go there." He then started to cry, just the saddest sobs, and kept asking, "Do I have to go there? Please don't make me." We just comforted him as much as possible, told him to rest and think of Jesus. For weeks after he died, the female patients in the facility would yell out at night about a big guy being in their room. Another nurse from my agency worked one night there and refused to go back, said it was haunted by something and it disturbed her psychically. Different nursing home on the Alzheimer's wing. The nurse's station had a plexiglass window on the wall looking out into the hallway. The nurse's desk was right in front of it. Sometimes residents would come up and look in. There were times I would be charting. I would swear I could see a face looking in at me, but when I looked up, no one was there. Personally, I become extremely nervous and jumpy, unable to sleep, agitated the night before someone dies. I woke up at 5:30 one morning with my dog whining at my bedroom door. My husband was asleep with me but didn't wake up. I felt someone with me, but no one was there. I felt like getting up and running. My dog kept whining and then just fell right to sleep. After my husband woke up, I told him what I felt. He said, "That's what you get for drinking Pepsi before bed." He left at 6 a.m. and at 6:30, my dad called to say my grandmother had died at 5:30 that morning. I think she came to say goodbye. This has happened when my husband's grandfather passed away and when a friend of mine was hospitalized and miscarried a baby. I tell my husband every morning to be careful when he leaves for work. One morning he said, "I will be careful and I'll even wear a hard hat today." He was in the United States Coast Guard and on a boat that day. He did as I said, and at one point while carrying a wooden box full of batteries, fell down a broken stairway that no one had roped off. He fell backwards, hitting his head in the hard hat on several stairs. He had some bumps and bruises and slipped a disc in his back, but his hard hat was split down the middle. I think as nurses, we have something in us that responds to danger and illness. Maybe it's a psychic sense, maybe it's intuition, maybe it's luck. But whenever I feel it, I listen. Story number 2. Here then is a story of the ghostly apparition at Gettysburg as it was related to me during a tour there some years ago. During the Civil War, Gettysburg College was known as Pennsylvania College. On the campus then as today sits what was then known as Pennsylvania Hall and now serves as the college administration building. In the late 80s, a pair of ladies were working late one evening on the top floor. Wrapping things up for the night, they entered the elevator to go down to the ground floor and from there out to their vehicles. There were only two problems. One, the elevator did not stop on the ground floor, but instead continued down to the basement level. And two, the elevator did not serve the basement level. The doors opened into a nightmarish scene straight out of antiquity. Before them was a Civil War hospital, complete with scurrying orderlies, sweating surgeons, and scores of wounded laid upon plank tables for surgery. You need to know in order to understand the scene what the mini ball was and did. They were actually conical bullets as opposed to the previously standard round lead balls. Propelled by black powder, they were slow, heavy, and frangible, and struck with tremendous force. When they struck bone, they expanded, as lead is wont to, shattering bone. Mortality from what were open fractures was significant. Medical science at the time was unable to effectively treat such wounds. The best hope for recovery lay with amputation, which there was a better than even chance of surviving versus mortality of 80 or 90% otherwise. The scene that presented itself before the two women was complete with sight, sound, and smell. There were the groans of the wounded, the smell of blood and gore, the flicker of candle and kerosene lanterns. Surgeons cleaved and sawed at limbs, working quickly to reduce shock. The area was wide open, with only supporting columns intervening in the space. Rude cots held patients either awaiting surgery or recovering. The clothing worn by the race seemed made flesh and blood once again was authentic in every detail. The crude instruments and leather tourniquets strictly period. Flesh was cauterized with a hot flat iron. There was no time to make nice flaps or even rows of sutures. If the patient survived the procedure by more than a few hours, the chances were good for recovery. As a woman stood there horrified, as you might imagine, staring at the scene made possible by an apparent rift in time, an orderly, the strain plainly showing on his face, turned toward the open elevator and witnessed the two women standing there in shock. He beckoned to them and began to approach them. Their reaction, as you may imagine, was to frantically hit the buttons for the door to close, the elevator to go anywhere else away from the scene before them. After what was reported to be an interminable period of time, but in actually probably lasted a mere handful of seconds, the doors closed and the elevator traveled upwards to the ground floor. The women exited as quickly as humanly possible, gaining their cars and fleeing the area. A security guard was reported to have been encountered as they departed, and they stopped long enough to explain in garbled fashion what they had witnessed. Of the two women, one never returned to the building, ever. The other older woman continued to work there for several more years at least, but reportedly never again used the elevator. The basement at that time, and presumably since, is divided into storage rooms. It is seldom, if ever, visited, as the heat is supplied via underground steam pipes issuing from a central plant serving several buildings on the campus. It represents nothing like the wide-open area witnessed by the two women. The history of the building shows, however, that the dividing up of the basement area came decades after the Civil War. It also shows that there was indeed a hospital sheltered in the basement during the Battle for Gettysburg. Such a location would have been considered as safe from shelling. The employee who remained there at the college after the apparition has been interviewed repeatedly and the story published in the official annals of Gettysburg hauntings. Next story. I'm a police officer who has had several run-ins with a diabolical, once in a hospital. I got a call for a 20-year-old female who punched her father. She was manic and upset with him because his ancestors were tormenting her. She said they were attacking her, as well as taking the form of insects and animals to talk to her. Law enforcement doesn't do exorcisms, so I had to take her for a psych evaluation under the imminent threat to others, which was her father. It was approved by the shrinks, and I took her to the hospital, which was Fairfax Hospital in Virginia, for medical clearance before going to the psych ward. While we were sitting in the private room in the ER, she talked to me and told me about what was happening to her in great detail. I'm no expert. I have no idea if she had severe mental issues or was struggling with diabolical possession, or both. I humored her in an effort to develop a rapport and keep her calm. She quieted down, and I started wondering my own thoughts. I was sitting in the corner in a chair, and she was on the hospital bed. The bed started rattling and shaking, and I paid no attention. You know how people will sit and shake their leg? That's what I thought it was. After it persisted and got kind of strong, I looked over at her to see what she was doing. She was sitting up on the bed with both legs drawn up close, and she was resting her cheek on her knees. She was doing nothing to shake the bed. There was no mechanical buzzing or noises. I was sitting and could feel that it was not an earthquake or the building shaking. I was looking at her and the bed trying to figure out what was going on when it suddenly stopped, and she had not changed her position or demeanor in any way. The moment after it stopped, a nurse walked into the room. That's the freakiest thing I've seen in the job in terms of possible over diabolical. P.S. I don't write nurse's tickets. I figure if I ever get a sudden onset of terminal lead poisoning at work, I don't want to see one of you who I just wrote a ticket to say, this may hurt. A little bit. Next story. I worked a couple of years for a small hospital-based service in Keokuk County, Iowa, back in the mid-late 80s. Prior to coming there, they had an event with a teenage male patient in an outlying town, the call coming in as possible suicide attempt. As it was described to me, they, as in the squatter crew, arrived on scene to find a modest crowd of people, including the first responders, standing outside staring at the house. No one, it seems, was inclined to remain inside with the subject. Upon entering, they found the teenager sitting in a chair in the living room, listening to, are you ready for this? Ozzy Osbourne. His demeanor was frankly described as freaky and displaced. He spoke with an otherworldly voice to the crew who questioned him while they treated modest cuts to his wrists. Okay, so far, just another freak show sort of call. But it gets weird, really weird. This was back when the monitor, a LifePak 5, was equipped with a simultaneous voice ECG recorder. The crew had put the monitor on the patient and were recording as a matter of routine, just another way to make notes for later, as well as record a continuous ECG without wasting paper. I would have called the following, just a case of getting at the new guy, had I not listened to the tape myself. It was preserved, as you will quickly see why, rather than erased for reuse later. On the tape, you can distinctly hear the one paramedic talking to the patient along with at least one first responder. They didn't go in with the crew. And also the other paramedic on the phone in the next room talking to medical control at a hospital in the next county. What you cannot hear, not even the hint of a whisper, was the voice of the patient. I've talked with both medics, one since deceased as well as others present, and all swear he was speaking in a conversational volume, but with a weird, unearthly deep voice. He identified himself as some sort of demon, as I recall, and said his intent was to cross over to the other side. This kid was about 16, and of course was taken in for a psych evaluation, such as it was worth. Within a year, he was found in a local cemetery, quite deceased of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. The tape was perfect. The blind spots, where he should have been speaking, you could hear the crew responding to his responses, had only the background noise you'd expect to be washed over by his closer voice. I would never have believed the tale of the tape if it had not been saved, and I listened to it on two separate occasions. Next story. I worked in a very haunted psychiatric facility here in the Midwest. I've worked there going on 26 years as a nurse's aide. I worked the graveyard shift, and over the last 25 years, I've experienced several hauntings. This is one of the most spooky events I've ever had. It was in early March of 1982, and I, of course, was working the graveyard shift. This is 10:45 p.m. to 6:45 a.m. I was returning to the area that I was assigned to work after having taken my break. I didn't like the unit where I was assigned, so I took an alternate, longer route back to my unit. I was walking down a long hallway in an area filled with doctor's offices. Since it was after midnight, there were no other staff in this locked part of the hospital. Each exit door you came to, you had to unlock to go through it and relock it when you left. I was about halfway down the long hallway when, out of force of habit, I reached into my pants pocket to retrieve my keys to unlock the upcoming exit door. Immediately, from about 2 feet above my head, I heard a loud, guttural male voice say, "You don't need your keys." I stopped dead in my tracks. I was shocked and frightened by what I had just heard. And from where? From the thin air above my head? In disbelief of what I had heard, I surmised that someone was playing a practical joke on me. So I searched for speaker wires and speakers, but I couldn't find any. Besides, no one knew I would be going through this seldom used section of the hospital that late at night. I figured I just had a wild imagination and chuckled sheepishly to myself. I continued down the long hallway. When I was about 15 feet from the exit, I again reached into my pocket to retrieve my keys to unlock the exit door. Again, from 2 feet above my head, I heard the voice again. This time, it was even louder and more fierce as it boomed out its message, "You don't need your keys." And with that, I shot right through the exit door and halfway down the adjacent hallway when I realized I hadn't used my keys to unlock the door. I cautiously walked back to the door and locked it. I didn't tell anyone about that experience for at least 3 months afterwards. As part of our continuing employee education program, that story has resurfaced several times when staff asked the education instructor if I suffer from schizophrenia because I admitted hearing a voice. She said no, just because we can't explain things that happen doesn't mean they didn't occur. She then admonished me for telling everyone about that incident. She says I need to use more restraint and whom I tell that story to. I agreed, but it's just too damn good of a story not to share it with others. Next story. I work in a very haunted psychiatric facility here in the Midwest. The facility is over 100 years old, and it's had its share of deaths in those 100 years. In the pauper cemetery, there are over 840 graves, each marked by a tombstone with a number on it to identify the dead. For confidentiality, no names or dates were ever put on the tombstones. Years ago, I was working the graveyard shift as a certified psychiatric nurse's aide on the open co-ed adult ward. On this particular night, as I was leaving the men's restroom, I met a fellow who was dressed in black shoes and was wearing a black satin or silk vestment or gown such as worn by the clergy of the Catholic Church. The gown had intricate stitching on it, which I felt dignified its wearer as someone of priestly stature in the church. We nearly collided as I left the bathroom. As my eyes were trained on the floor as I walked out of the restroom, I'm prone to tripping due to an ankle injury. I knew the doorway had a bit of a lip that my left foot needed to clear when I walked through the exit door of the restroom. Looking down as I took my first step out of the restroom, I saw the Monsignor's black shoes and gown coming straight at me. In order to avoid the impending collision, I abruptly stopped and took one step backward. As I did, I trained my eyes on the Monsignor's feet. My gaze scanned upward to identify who I was about to run into. When my eyes reached where the figure's knees would have been, there was nothing to see. There was no body above the knees. When I quickly glanced to the feet again, there was nothing there either. The Monsignor had vanished into thin air. And by the way, a Monsignor is a member of the clergy who is higher than a priest, but lower than a bishop, so I understand. I felt the spirit I met fit into that category. Next story. The names have been changed in this story to protect the innocent. It's been several years ago, but a dear friend and co-worker of mine that we'll call Buffy Stumpwater had an experience worth mentioning. Back in the good old days when we were allowed to read or play cards in the graveyard shift, when our work rounds were completed, my friend Buffy was startled one night. She was engrossed in some fiery romance novel that she was reading when she heard this wobbling noise coming from the wall across the hall from where she was seated. She looked up just in time to see a 6-inch plastic wall plaque of a Dutch boy fly off the wall. The plaque landed about 6 feet from the wall and rolled out to the center of the hall. I normally worked with Buffy, but I'd taken night off from work. When Buffy would read her romance novels, I would sit at a table playing cards with my back to the Dutch boy plaque. Buffy said had I been to work that night, the plaque would have hit me in the head as it flew off the wall. The following night, I was loaned out to another unit to work. After hearing about Buffy's experience, I quickly took my break and headed over to her unit to investigate the plaque and try to figure out what would cause it to fly off the wall. Upon looking at the plaque, I discovered it had one of those keyhole hooks on it, the type that slides over the head of a nail and secures it to the wall. In order to remove it from the wall, you need to deliberately slip it up and off this bracket to remove it. But it came off the wall all by itself, seemingly at least to Buffy. I couldn't figure out how it could have come off the wall. Still, having time to kill on my break, Buffy and I became engrossed in a card game that another co-worker, that we'll call Trudy Hardluck, had joined in on. We were all engrossed in the card game when all three of us heard the Dutch boy wobbling on the wall. We all looked up at the plaque just as it flew off the wall. I was seated just to the left of where I normally would sit at that table. The wall plaque flew off the wall towards me and landed on the floor near my feet and then rolled under the table. I joked nervously, saying, "That's just the way the ghosts let me know that they miss me when I took the other night off from work." I then went into the nurse's station and balled up some masking tape and crammed it into the concave back of the plaque and re-secured it to the wall on the keyhole hook. I then exclaimed to the ghost, "There, let's see you remove that." The plaque remained there for months until the housekeepers replaced it with another artsy plaque. I haven't seen the Dutch boy since. Next story. I do work on the grounds of an old mental hospital, but I've had a few weird experiences at our home in our master bathroom. My first experience was a few years back, and I was drying my hair in our master bathroom in front of the vanity. I'd flipped my head over to blow my hair dry underneath when all of a sudden I felt someone touching the back of my right knee. To me, it felt like someone had reached out and put a finger on me. There was nothing in the room behind me I could have brushed up against. I whipped up, thinking my husband must have come in, poked at me, then ran away. I shut off the blow dryer and went out to our TV and found my husband on the couch watching TV. "Very funny," I said. He looked dumbfounded and said, "What?" I explained to him what happened, made him swear on a Bible he didn't do it, and then I got freaked out. He teased me for weeks about it. Then, several weeks after that, my husband said I sat up in bed in the middle of the night, let out a blood-curdling scream, pointed to our open master bathroom door and yelled, "There's a man in an orange jumpsuit in our bathroom." My husband jumped up, flipped on the lights, and went to the bathroom to look and saw nothing, and said when he came back to the room to tell me I was fast asleep. I don't even remember the incident, but my husband told me he laid awake the rest of the night with his heart pounding, thinking a deranged escaping from the prison was in our house. About 3 months after that, I woke up in the middle of the night and saw a very tall man standing in the doorway of our master bathroom. That one I remember, and it scared the bejeebies out of me. I woke my husband up, who did a whole house search before I could get back to sleep. After those incidents, we started shutting the door to our master bathroom at night. Next story. This story is about my parents and about their first house, the one they used to live in, the one they said was haunted. They were searching for a house to rent. They'd just gotten married, and they found a nice one for an excellent price in a great neighborhood. They were very excited because they were low on cash. They moved in, and at first everything was okay. But after a few weeks, strange things started happening. The front door had a deadbolt and a chain lock. They would both lock it at night. Well, for 1 week straight, they would wake up in the middle of the night freezing. My dad would get up, and the front door would be wide open. Not only were they scared, but they were fed up. One night, my dad locked the door as usual and put a chair in front of the door. When they woke up early that morning, freezing as usual, the chair was back at the table and the door was wide open again. After that, however, they never had another problem with the door. A few weeks later, my dad was watching the Super Bowl on TV. He was cleaning his rod and reel. He got up to use the restroom, and when he returned, his reel was gone. He looked everywhere. A week later, he found his reel in a plastic bag under the sink. A lot of other creepy things happened. The house stayed cold constantly. The power bill was always sky high. My dad called the power company to see if this had been an issue with previous renters. The power company said they didn't have any good records because no one ever stayed in the house longer than 3 months. They were scared to death at this point. After a few more things went missing, My mom's kitchen knives ended up behind the fridge. They decided to move out. They never saw or heard anything. Was it a poltergeist? We don't know, and I'm sure they really didn't want to find out. Next story. Many years ago, on the women's locked ward, I experienced a freaky situation. I was working the graveyard shift, and for 3 nights straight, a very heavy set female patient, which had been restrained to bed and heavily medicated in an attempt to control her aggressive, threatening behavior. She was not only a threat to herself, but also to everyone in the unit. She was a very large and strong woman who was prone to violence towards others. The entire time she was restrained, she would stare at the wall opposite the foot of her bed, and she would speak in a deep, guttural voice in a language unknown to any of us. It really sounded like some demonized language, and she spit and sputtered as she snarled and glared at the wall. She clearly was interacting with someone or something that none of us could see. While all the time she resisted against the restraints, she occasionally was able to slip out of the restraints, requiring additional staff to assist to get her back into the full bed restraints she was kept in. They had given her every medication they could think of, and multiple doses of many neuroleptics, but nothing fazed the sheer brutish energy that raged inside her body. Plus, all during these 3 days, she never slept once. It was about 1 a.m., and I was standing out in the hallway, about 15 feet from patient number 2 or 3, where other staffs were tending to the restrained patient, giving her yet another injection, trying to calm her down. I stood with a young LPN as we watched the going on in the patient's room. I leaned in close to the LPN, and in a hushed voice, I said to her, "When they behave this way, I truly believe they are demon-possessed." There was no way the patient heard me say this. But no sooner had I said that, the patient turned abruptly away from the wall she had been growling at and glared at me and said loudly in her deep guttural voice, "And you need to lose some weight, fat boy." And just as quickly as she said that, she reengaged whatever she was interacting with in her wall, speaking in her deep guttural demon-sounding voice. Within 15 minutes, she was sound asleep. I truly do believe she was demon-possessed, and that the demon in her would have kept up ranting and raving as it had done for the last 3 days and nights if I hadn't spoke of its presence. Except that when I admitted to that LPN that I thought the patient was demon-possessed, that was all the demon had wanted, was for someone to recognize that they were present in that patient. After that, the demon was satisfied and allowed the patient to rest. Several of my co-workers disagreed, saying that the patient would on occasion say very lucid things. But I tell you, her voice sounded very demonistic to me, and most everyone who observed her during that 3-day period thought the same, though most would never admit it for fear of being ridiculed as being mentally deranged themselves. Was it just a coincidence, or was she really demon-possessed? We'll never know for sure. Next story. The names have been changed to protect the innocent. I was working the graveyard shift on the children's unit with a co-worker named Gil Churchman. Back in the good old days, we could play cards, read books, but Gil's and my passion was playing chess. One fateful night that we were working together, we ended up playing 27 games of chess. Woohoo! Anyway, I digress. During the middle of all these 27 games, I asked him if he was seeing anything strange going on in the south hallway. He said he had seen a man standing in the center of the hall looking at us. He said he was dressed in khaki-colored shoes, khaki-colored socks, khaki-colored jeans, and a khaki-colored shirt. This was the first encounter of the khaki-colored ghost that I remember, although I have to admit I did not see the khaki ghost this night. I was having my own bizarre paranormal experience that night on that ward. I saw a strange dark blue object move left to right across the hall, but at the ceiling height. This object came straight out of the left wall and straight into the right wall, unencumbered by the brick walls. That ward was South 5. It was one of the most haunted wards in a hospital, though it seems that the South wards all in general are more haunted than those on the north side of the hospital. All the South side wards are now under the jurisdiction of another agency, and the hospital staff are not allowed to go in these areas anymore. Dang, I miss the activity that I experienced over there. I have asked Gil once several years after the khaki-colored ghost encounter if he remembers that night. He says He has no memory of that encounter. Next story. The other night I was talking to one of the workers from a hospital powerhouse. He was telling me that one graveyard shift that he was working back on about 7 or 8 years ago, he was alone in the powerhouse. It's staffed with only one person at night. He said out of the corner of his eye, he saw a tall, thin man sprint across the powerhouse's broad floor. He described the man as being in his early 30s with dark hair. He went to investigate to see who it was and couldn't find anyone. He says he experiences things occasionally, has that feeling at times that there is some type of presence around him, though he doesn't see anything. I asked him if he gets the heebie-jeebies in the tunnels that connect all of our buildings on campus. There's one area under Ward North 2 in the basement hallway that seems to make everyone's hair on the back of their neck stand straight up when they pass through there. But here's another story, and it has to do with a khaki-colored ghost. It's been umpteen years since we had to provide cigarettes for the indigent patients at the hospital I worked at. Back in the old days, an hour or so of our time was spent each night rolling cigarettes for the patients who couldn't afford to buy their own. Needless to say, these rolled cigs didn't have anything more than tobacco and the paper they were rolled with. We were provided with a rolling machine that produced one cig at a time. Each night, we had to roll 100 cigs for the indigent patients. That is not to say that each patient would get 100 cigs. They didn't. They got maybe one cig before or after each meal, and one at night. Anyway, one night, I was rolling cigs at a desk with my back to the hallway. This left me at a disadvantage if any violent patient would approach me and attack me. It would be very difficult to defend myself with my legs tucked in under the desk and my back to them. So I kept my eyes peeled to my back, using my peripheral vision to scout out any movement behind me. I sat across the hall from the bedroom of one of the most violent men we had at the time, and he was the type to take advantage of a situation like this to attack an unsuspecting staff person, though thankfully he was in bed asleep at the time. However, he still posed a threat to me if he should get up, so I was very mindful of noises and movements behind me. As I neared the 90th cigarette that I had rolled that night, I spied in my left peripheral vision a man standing just out of arm's reach from me over my left shoulder. He was dressed in khaki-colored canvas shoes and khaki-colored slacks. I kept my eye trained on his feet so I could detect any forward movement and try to fend off any attack if that's what he had in mind for me. Also, I thought if I jumped up abruptly, showing how frightened I was by his presence, that he would think I was a coward and an easy target to attack. So I just watched him. I finished my last cigarette, number 100, and packed up my supplies to put back in the office. I decided it was time to confront the patient and ask what it is they wanted, that they had stood behind me long enough without saying anything. Keeping my eyes trained on his feet, I turned in my chair, and as I did, I scanned up his legs, but when I got to his knees, there was nobody above it, and when I glanced back down to his feet, they had disappeared too. This was the second occurrence I had of seeing a partial apparition, but this would not be the last time I saw or heard of this khaki-colored ghost.